Hello and welcome to a very quick episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast today. I think that it would be pretty helpful to talk through why you should not be afraid of the student loan chaos and mess that is going on in the Department of Education right now. You might immediately be super skeptical of what I just said. Why is he telling me to not be afraid when things are freaking terrifying right now? I want to share a little bit of a personal story with you guys. Maybe this is TMI, but I think it's still kind of helpful to kind of understand who is this random guy talking on the podcast that some of you guys have listened to for quite some time. I have, for years, struggled with anxiety disorder. People talk about anxiety as like fear in search of an object. And with our always on nature of everything in life, with our always on kind of news cycle, and just the fact that we can get news now instantly anywhere from around the world, not just delivered to our phone, but dinging on our phone constantly, right? So it is absolutely true that when the news feels overwhelming right now, like a lot of situations, it's like for people's mental health, you're just tuning out, completely ignoring everything. But then if you tune out everything, you're scared because you're like, but am I going to miss something that would really hurt me if I like miss out on it? So it's just, yeah, overwhelming is a really good word to use right now. One of the things that I think has been really helpful for me personally is the counseling has taught me so much about myself, and it's been so helpful to realize like, hey, like sometimes you have to call out the catastrophizing, you have to call out sort of the worst fears that you might have about something, and you have to kind of go straight to the, well, what's the absolute worst case thing that can happen? And let's talk about that so that we can take away some of the fear and replace it with some peace, which is so important, so critical, and it's so healthy. That's the idea that I had of today's episode, is to talk through some recent survey findings of our audience that we did. And it is really shocking. It's very saddening. It makes me sad to read it, some of these findings. But at the same time, I know how much hope is out there because I know the loopholes, and that's what we're experts in. So let me call out some of the things that I was rather burdened by from the survey that we did recently of our student loan planner audience. And what we did is we asked people, do you think IBR is going, 20 to 25 year IBR is going to be gone by the end of 2025? 40% of people said yes. That's a lot of people that think that forgiveness is just going to be completely gone by the end of this year. We asked the same thing about PSLF. We said, do you think PSLF is going to be gone by the end of 2025? About 25% of people said yes. So a quarter of all people said they thought it was going to be gone. Some other interesting stats from that survey, 40% of people roughly said that when IBR payments sort of get recertified and you know, save gets eliminated, 40% of people said they will not be able to afford their monthly payment. That was heavy. That was shocking to see that stat. But at the same time, in the same survey, we asked married couples, how are you filing your taxes? Something like 3/5 or so were filing joint of all married couples. That was also very shocking to me, because what that tells me is a lot of people are not paying attention to how they could take action to reduce their student loan payments. And it makes sense as to why. A huge amount of people have not recertified since before the pandemic. So if we look at the cadres of people in terms of their recertification dates, at least in our audience, we had two huge groups. We had a lot of people that have literally not touched their IDR recertification since pre-pandemic, which means they are literally recertified using like 2018 tax returns, and it's 7 years later. And then there was another cadre that recertified last in 2024. So that kind of makes sense to me why so many people are filing their taxes jointly, because so many people have not recertified in so long that they forget the impact of filing separately on their student loans. And then people who recertified more recently just haven't had to worry about it, because when you graduate, usually your most recent tax return is a really small tax return. And so you're not really having a big payment because your prior year taxable income was so low. So with these two cadres of people, it does make sense to me that a lot of people would have made other plans for their budgets. It makes total sense that people have taken the money and already spent it on things like nicer housing or housing at all, having a safe car for their family, daycare, vacations with friends and family that are reasonable vacations. We're not talking about somebody staying in the Taj Mahal here. This is probably literally just, I want to be able to say that I took my kids to Disney, and yeah, going to Disney is expensive. Yeah, you could make the argument there's life's full of trade-offs, you have to make choices, but let's have some empathy for folks going through this situation. It makes total sense to me that if you have a no or $0 payment for 7 years, or I guess 5 years, right? Because we're talking about 2018 tax returns recertifying people, not that they weren't making payments in 2018 and 19. But if you have a multi-year period where people are making no payments, and then your solution to the student loan crisis with the Biden administration was, let's create a payment plan that is so generous that the majority of people will pay zero. And then you have a new administration that is anti-forgiveness and wants to raise people's payments to have more of an attitude that people should pay off their loans. The problem is just like, of course, this is going to create a lot of problems. I mean, it's sort of like the only way it wouldn't have created a lot of problems is if you did have a, you know, in terms of student loan forgiveness programs, not putting any burden at all on people's budgets, would have been if you had sort of a Democratic White House with the Democratic, or I shouldn't say Democratic leaning, but, you know, a progressive leaning judiciary, right? Because then they would have upheld a lot of these things. And yeah, like it would have caused people's student loan burdens to be lower. But that's not the world we have. And so with the world that we have, how do borrowers, you know, of any political persuasion feel at peace with their student loans when there's so much at stake? If the majority of borrowers are filing married filing jointly, that means that a whole bunch of borrowers could drastically lower their payments by filing separately instead, particularly if some loopholes happen that I won't go in full detail into this podcast, but the old definition of family size, well, I guess I can go in a little detail because I did mention, I teased it a little bit in some of our newsletter stuff. Back in the day, it used to be that if you both had loans and you both had kids, or, you know, you had kids together, then each of you could essentially claim the kids in both of your IDR recertifications. So that used to be the rule, and now it wasn't because of this save plan rule, but that whole save plan rule is under an injunction and could get tossed. And so if that happens, for example, there might be opportunities that might enable people to file taxes separately in a way that would help save money on student loans, even if both people have the debt. So that those are just some examples at a high level of how people could really potentially do some really cool stuff to lower their payments, where it would not have to be 2 in 5 people saying that they couldn't afford their IBR payment if they restart in a normal way again. So a couple other reasons to be a little bit more hopeful, okay? The ICR statute and the lawsuit that's surrounding the ICR plan, if that plan falls, technically these plans are in other statutes. So yeah, maybe it says you can't get forgiveness, but does that mean the whole plan's cut off? I don't know. It depends on what the court says. But my guess would be that the plan would not be cut off completely from people using it, but you just couldn't use it to get the 20-year or 25-year forgiveness. And if that's the case, then somebody that uses Pay, even though it's technically an illegal plan, might be able to legally get PSLF using Pay, which could help people a whole lot get access to a partial financial hardship, which is where when your payment is lower than the standard 10-year plan, which is what you need to be able to get enrolled into an income-driven plan like Pay and IBR. And when you're enrolled in those plans, then when your income's too high and your payment gets capped at the standard 10-year plan, then you're good. But this stuff's complicated. It's really complicated. Back when I first started doing this, honestly, the standard 10-year plan, I used to think, well, that's a really viable plan for somebody that needs to switch over for, you know, 2-3 years to have capped payments to get forgiveness. But what I missed in the regulations from way back when is in the regulations, it actually says that you're supposed to amortize the standard 10-year plan on the remaining balance of counting the time you've already been in a repayment to have it fully paid off in a 10-year window. So what that means is, let's say you've been an IBR for 5 years. Well, your standard plan, if you have not consolidated your loans, is actually supposed to be amortized according to the remaining 5-year period to have it fully paid off in 10 years. So that is why people are getting these notices in the mail right now with servicers. Like, it's just absolutely terrifying people, because the notice essentially is saying, if you do not recertify, then by the rules, we have to put you on the standard plan. And if you've not consolidated your loans, the standard plan is the 10-year plan, but it's amortized according to how much repayment length you have left to pay it off in 10 years. And because of COVID, basically everybody's got 4 or 5 years of credit. So instead of like a standard plan that is like reasonable, like the standard 10-year plan, it really works out to like a standard 4, 5, or 6-year plan. And the old servicers, I'm pretty sure, just kind of ignored this regulation and never actually applied it, because I don't remember them doing this before COVID in terms of the way that they did these amortized payments. It's this case of even rules that I forgot about, you know, and I do obviously been doing this 9 years. I do know the rules fairly well. Not perfectly, but fairly well. Even I'm finding stuff that I forgot that, oh yeah, that is technically how they're supposed to do it. It's just that they never did it that way before in the past. So again, you might say, how can you not be fearful with all this? How can you not be just absolutely terrified, right? Let me give you another example why you shouldn't be terrified. It is true that pre-Biden administration on forgiveness, PSLF had this terrible success rate. I've talked about this in many podcasts. The reason it had a terrible success rate is that's because that's exactly what the Democratic Party intended and knew was going to happen. And I'm going to explain why. Okay, in 2007, they passed IBR and PSLF with a Democratic Congress that was installed after a big election win in 2006 because the Iraq War was really unpopular and George W. Bush was really unpopular. So that Congress took power, and then they put forward the PSLF and IBR programs, and the Bush administration signed it into law. And as part of that, at the time, there was these FFEL loans, FEL loans, right? Federal Family and Education Loan Program. And these programs allowed private lenders like Sallie Mae and student loan trust kind of groups and all these different groups at the time could earn interest income from the government for having these loans issued. And so it was very, and a lot of state agencies did this too. This was how a lot of state agencies that did random like scholarship programs and that kind of thing got all their funding, was the interest income from these FFELP program loans. So those lenders really did not want those loans to go away because they were real big money makers for them. And then the other thing is, because of the budgetary rules, there's something called pay-fors. So if something is spending related and it costs money, you either have to offset with spending cuts somewhere else, or you have to raise taxes. Those are the rules that you have to do based off of the way Congress does things. Basically, the Congress looked at those rules and realized, oh, wait a second. If we put FFELP loans into eligibility directly for PSLF, we'll get a bunch of lobbying power from these private lenders that's going to push back on it, and we'll have to pay way more money and higher taxes or spending cuts in other programs to be able to pass the bill in the first place. Those are the political constraints and the political realities that the Democrats at the time were dealing with. And so what they did is they passed a literally intentionally flawed bill, because that is the only way that they were going to get something like IBR and PSLF passed in the first place, because they could not pass a bill that would cause FFELP loans to be included except through a backdoor. So what did they do? They created a backdoor to make FFELP loans eligible by consolidating the loans. That would make them direct loans, and that would make them eligible for all these new programs like PSLF and everything else. What happened around the 2009-2010 era is President Obama and his administration used that 60-vote Senate majority to avoid the filibuster to have student loan reform be part of what technically paid for the Affordable Care Act. The thought process was, well, if you take all these billions of dollars of interest income that's going to private lenders, and then you have it go to the federal government instead, well, the federal government's going to make all these profits, and it's going to partially pay for the Affordable Care Act. Well, obviously, that was wishful thinking in terms of the budgetary rules. And the reason it was wishful thinking is because once that interest income was being earned by the government, well, the government is not a private lender. They don't have any like specific profit need or motive. And so those billions of dollars of interest income, well, if you make the loan rules more generous and make more loans forgivable, then all that interest income is basically fake interest income. And it's actually a cost, not an asset in terms of income. That's not to say that they shouldn't have done that, by the way. I'm just sharing all this stuff so you can understand how complex the political realities are that lead to the student loan programs being so screwed up. So you create this new program, you create new IBR with the Affordable Care Act era, and that's going to be what's going to partially pay for the Affordable Care Act. But new IBR, because it's so good, you can't start it until much later because of a 10-year budget scoring window. So we're going to have this new IBR only start for new borrowers as of 2014, even though the Affordable Care Act passed in like 2009, right? 2010 kind of time frame. Why? Well, it's because somebody that's in school start as a new borrower in 2014 would not graduate till 2018, and that is almost outside of that window of 10 years for CBO budget scoring, where any costs associated with that new IBR program don't have to be put into the bill now. And you can completely dodge the realities of how expensive that new IBR program is going to be in statute, because you got yourself outside of that 10-year budgetary window when things would be scored. And then once they pass that law, well, obviously they want to early implement that law because President Obama is running for re-election in 2012. What do? They early implement the pay program because it's got the same exact terms as new IBR, but they couldn't make it eligible for people too much. Otherwise, it might have been tossed much earlier. So what do? They made it eligibility new borrower as of 2007. That was because President Obama was giving a speech to the graduating class of University of Iowa in 2012. Those people started college in 2008. All of them are eligible for pay as you earn. That was an announcement he was able to make to that group of people about what he was doing to make student loan repayment more affordable. All that stuff happened, you know, but then the Obama administration realized, we have these runaway interest numbers. The pay program ended up being a little bit more generous to grad students than they really would have liked compared to people that have 10K of loans and are really struggling to just pay anything. And so they realized, let's try to make it so that the repay program will control some of the interest. We're going to take away that married filing separate loophole that's predominantly benefiting, you know, higher income earners, and we're going to try to make this eligible for everybody, not just new borrowers, just to give people more access to reasonable payment plans. And then during the Trump 1.0 administration, it was an unexpected win in the first place, I think. Their team didn't really know exactly what they wanted to do for a little while, right? It was mostly focused on repealing the Affordable Care Act and the tax cuts. All that stuff happened. And then before you know it, they lost the ability to pass things with unified control. And then COVID happened. That dominated absolutely everything. And the one thing President Trump did do on student loans is pause all interest. Why? He wanted to win re-election. He also probably also wanted to stimulate the economy like any president probably would have during a massive disruption like COVID. That was essentially his idea of extending that student loan pause of on interest. That was obviously something that was politically motivated for him to try to avoid losing. And so he extended that student loan pause and then obviously didn't win. And then the Biden administration very much needed to shore up support on the progressive left for his candidacy because he's trying to be the candidate of the whole Democratic Party. And student loans ended up just being a way that he could do that without losing like a bunch of moderate voters, because those folks just, I think, essentially didn't pay attention a whole lot to the student loan stuff compared to some of the other stuff. Obviously, Biden struggled with young people a lot. And he viewed the student loan issue, I think, as just a proxy for how do you build support among young people that are not that enthusiastic about his candidacy in the first place. And so they kind of offloaded a lot of that decision-making authority to more like progressive-leaning consumer advocacy kind of groups, right? Like Student Borrower Protection Center, Senator Warren's office, I think really drove a lot of the policymaking in Department of Ed during Biden's term. And I think that the White House was happy with that because they were able to be at peace with the more progressive wing in their party. And obviously, he wanted to run again in 2024 too and needed that support from the progressive wing of his party to make sure that there was no challengers to his candidacy with him being a flawed candidate. Obviously, that we know that now, of course. And so what I'm going on, I guess, in sort of a random or historical walk through the student loan history politically is I also kind of just wanted to talk to you about how, just how politically charged all this stuff is. It's always super political with student loans. What we've had really since the end of the Obama administration is since really 2007, I guess. 2007 is the last time that student loan legislation was like somewhat bipartisan, right? You've got a Democratic Congress and George W. Bush making agreement on a student loan issue. Ever since then, student loans have become more and more and more partisan, and really extremely so. And so you get this sort of also split along educational lines with the Trump administration, where you've got way more educated people disproportionately voting for Democrats and president, and then obviously President Trump's coalition being way more working class and having less education levels than like other previous Republican coalitions. And so you get this split where it's like, yeah, okay, like Democratic administration going to be caring a lot about student loan borrowers because that's like the core of their constituency of is highly educated people, right? Republican administration, you know, very heavily now more so than ever, like a working class kind of party and coalition. And so they care less about student loan issues and related things like that. And so we are dealing with an administration that kind of believes that people should pay back their debts that they owe. They think that the forgiveness path has been a wrong path. And so I'm not saying that you don't get to fear. You get to feel however you want to feel. But consider that the GOP's position on this is mostly one of wanting people to pay back their loans, but also not really caring all that much about student loans. Yeah, they want to cut back on the Department of Ed heavily, but that's really more inspired more by their views of like primary and secondary school education policy and wanting to be hands-off on the states on that. For higher education stuff, they obviously withheld like $400 million of loans and grants or something like that from Columbia University because they wanted to punish them over the student protests that were going on in their campus. But what happened, as far as I'm aware at least, is when I recorded this, they opened up that funding again after Columbia punished a lot of the people that they wanted them to punish. So with PSLF in the first term, it was really, really hard to get PSLF, but something like 1,000 people or something like that did get PSLF during the first Trump term. Who were those people? People who followed the letter of the rules exactly. People that were on top of it perfectly. People that knew exactly what plans to be on, how to keep track of their payment counts. They probably religiously submitted PSLF certification forms. So I guess my point is the volatility in student loans comes with the territory. Anybody who does not want to have any volatility on their student loan plan needs to pay back their loans. And that could be a mistake if your loan math is super, super pro forgiveness with the debt to income ratio or the career path of public sector that you're on, for example. So what I'm saying on the catastrophizing piece of why it's not good to do that in this case is it is true that this is the most disruptive it's felt like on student loans in quite some time. But it's also true that that literally is part of the design of the program because the programs are so messed up and the political incentives are so great to fight for your core base if you're the Democrats, or stop woke if you're the Republicans. That's kind of the political incentives right now. And so what matters is what's actually in the statute, because that can't be messed with unless you've got a ton of votes in Congress with a filibuster-proof majority, right? And you're going to see a bunch of lawsuits around this too. Like whatever, even the worst headline is not the final say, because there's going to be lawsuits, there are going to be challenges to this. And, you know, ultimately, I do actually think that what's in the statute is going to prevail. I might be naive, but what I mean by what's in the statute is, yeah, like there's some things they can do are pretty scary, right? Like letting go half the Department of Ed is pretty scary. But what that's going to do is take away people from those, you know, ombudsman groups and the helplines that could help correct errors. But people that know how to contact constituent services and contact the right senator's office strategically, that can write the right request to that senator's office, are going to be the people that get their loans corrected according to what the payment count should be. And the people who unfortunately are not as resourced, who are not as in the know, who are not listening to podcasts like these, are going to be the people who are going to really struggle. And I feel bad about that. I feel sad about that for those borrowers. I do. But at the same time, I know that I don't have to feel scared for you listening to this. And I know that sounds maybe nuts to you. But what I'm thinking is the majority of people are not optimizing their student loan payments. I know that because it's literally what I do. We find savings maybe 90, 95% of the time because usually people are missing something. I know that that's the case. So I know that if people get help and get optimized more on their student loans and get more awareness of their student loans, they will pay less. They will be able to afford more. I also know that usually from thousands and thousands of consults that I've done, usually when somebody can't afford their student loans, it's because of their car or their house. Almost always it's because of housing expense or transportation expense. If you make a change in only one of those in some way, usually all the budget problems go away. And a lot of times there's no way around dealing with you not being able to afford something than to address one of those two. And sometimes it's really unpleasant. Sometimes it's not fun at all. But sometimes that is a better option than trying to dig your way out of a budget problem by saving $5 lattes. It just, the math doesn't work. You generally have to target big fixed expenses, and it's usually one of two big fixed expenses is cars and houses, right? And if you're just breaking even and your savings rate's not good because your student loans jump up a whole lot, well, have context. Think about, do you have PSLF on the horizon? Is this going to be temporary because your PSLF's in 4 years? Do you have kids in daycare where that expense is going to go away? Do you have kids in private school where maybe you won't always need to have them in private school? And if you're struggling to want to buy a house and you feel like it's difficult to afford everything while you're trying to buy a house as well, think about your price to rent ratio for your area. Is it even a wise decision to buy a house in your area financially in the first place? Like in San Francisco, price to rent ratio, it's like a ratio of like 30 to 50, which means it's like a 30 to 50 year payback on renting versus buying. You know, that just doesn't make any sense at all to buy a house, period, unless you just care about it that much. Like it'd be better to go decorate your rental is the way you want to and just literally pay the landlord a bunch of money to change it back to the way it was. It'd be way cheaper. I'm not saying that to be insensitive, right? But it's just, if you live in a certain kind of place, like, you know, Omaha, yeah, definitely buy a house. It's a good idea. If you live in a place like San Francisco or DC or New York City, maybe it's not a good idea unless you have a lot of excess income and your really high savings rate. I do want to encourage people in a way that's not depressing though, because PSLF is going to stick around. You don't have to worry about that 25% group that felt was going to go away. It's not going to go away. 40% people think that IBR is going to go away. It's also not going to go away. So those are two things that I feel extremely confident that they will stay around. They might be reined in. They might be a little bit more restricted. They might be a little bit harder to access. It might be more confusing. You might have to verify you've got the right credit that you really should have. And with looking at your NSLDS file, and you might need to know how to contact your congressperson or senator's office to get IDR waiver like credit mistakes fixed. So all those things might be true, but you have a valuable set of skills. You are a highly educated person. You are eminently more employable than the average American. You have a way lower unemployment rate in times of deep recession and financial distress. Your unemployment rate is, for your profession, is probably 2 to 6% during a recession. Most people's unemployment rate jumps up to 10, 15%. So not only do you earn above average incomes probably for most people, except for the teachers and therapists and those kind of folks, social workers listening to this, which we appreciate you by the way, most of you are going to be having significantly higher than average household incomes. I think about 2/3 of our community has a household income, maybe even 3/4 has a household income above 100K. Median income in America, I think, is like 60 or something like that. So already your income is way above average and your skill set is way above average, which means your unemployment rate, again, in times when things are really messed up, is way below average. And so it's absolutely true that if you compare yourself to the richest person that you went to grad school with, that you face more financial struggles. That is true. But if you comparison's the thief of joy. So I want to just build you up right now. I want to tell you that all this stress, all this chaos, burn in bed, do not let it affect your mental health. It is not worth it. Your student loans at some point will be gone, either because you listen to stuff like this and we help you get them forgiven or paid off, or because I send you to one of my lawyer friends that's a pit bull that's going to help you get it discharged in some sort of strategic bankruptcy or something, right? I'm always amazed at some of the stuff that some of my student loan lawyer friends are able to achieve. Now, they, I think, would also tell you that they never want to go that path if there's other paths available, because it's just a bunch of stress for no reason. So you always want to try the, how do I use the rules? How do I anticipate what rule changes could be to get as much savings as I possibly can get? How do I keep my head down and stay positive, stay calm, and grow my net worth with other areas of my life that I could optimize so that I'm not losing ground, I'm gaining ground? So that I'm not falling behind on my journey to financial independence, I'm accelerating it. And so if you feel down, if you feel sad, just know that I have felt that way a lot of the time over the past 9 years of doing this at different periods of time, because being in this space sometimes is absolutely exhausting, because leaders don't keep their promises, leaders will say things that they can't actually back up, and they constantly change their minds, and they come up with all this complexity, and nobody wants to do the right thing, like, for example, pay for customer service for servicers to not stink. But I recognize, and when I'm able to be extremely happy doing this, I'm actually very happy doing this. And the reason I am is because I recognize that this is the industry that I'm in. This is the nature of the beast. Student loans suck. Nobody wants to have them. Nobody enjoys having their student loans. But the great news is the thing that you got because you have student loans is hopefully this richer life, this social circle of friends, this life experience, this unique group of clients or patients that you're able to help that you otherwise couldn't, your protection from unemployment, your higher than average incomes, your better than average benefits at work, and your hopefully path a sense of meaning in the workforce. So when you put it in that context, all this chaos is messed up, and hopefully it'll be done soon where things will be calmer. But just stay positive, because you have so much to be grateful for, as do I. And even in the face of all this stress, there's light at the end of the tunnel. There's loopholes you're not aware of. You can absolutely do this. You can absolutely reach your goals faster than you think is possible. So hopefully I've encouraged you. If you have questions you want to ask or comments for the show that you want us to feature, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. You might have seen stuff about our SLP Insiders paid newsletter community. If you want to join that, studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a discount on that. And obviously, you know how to get a student loan consult at the website, studentloanplanner.com, if you feel like you need a refresher or a new plan. I'm deeply grateful for you listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I always try to speak from the heart, try to speak with things that I hope can encourage you and can entertain you and can keep you positive during a very stressful time. So I'm sure that we will have lots of podcasts this year that are stressful. So just keep all that in perspective whenever something stressful happens, right? How blessed am I that I have the ability to practice and make a difference in people's lives, and just know that there are loopholes that you're not aware of that can make your life even better. And hopefully I can share those on this podcast with you and encourage you. So stay strong. We'll get through this together. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.